Betty, The Final Frontier. These are the voyages of the Bet with the Best podcast. Its mission is to explore better ways to bet on races, to seek out new, successful players, and to boldly go where no podcast has gone before.
The Bet with the Best podcast is sponsored by AmWager, an ADW built by horse players for horse players. Speed, power, and ease of use are at the core of AmWager. The platform is packed with features including live video, race replays, conditional wagering, and true odds, a predictive estimate of the off odds that will give you an edge. AmWager gives players the information and tools they need to quickly make anything from a win bet to a complex structured group of pick five tickets using the ABC strategy. With a rating of over 4.5 stars on Google, AmWager is a favorite among horse players. Sign up now at AmWager.com to take advantage of the simplest sign-up bonus in the business, a 100% first deposit match up to $150. If you want to bet with the best, then you need an edge. You need AmWager.
Welcome to episode number 52 of the Bet with the Best podcast. Joining us on the show is Bruno DiGiulio, who has spent many years analyzing workouts and providing information to horse players. Welcome to the show, Bruno. How's it going?
Hey, thank you. I guess I've been in the game now. Well, I've been clocking since 91. So doing the math, that's 30.
A long time.
4 years.
That's a long time. So,
been around a while. I started out, I just started out one day. Girlfriend, when I was 21, took me to Del Mar. And I kept bugging her, we're in the in the plaza area. And I said, I've been here for 2 hours. I ain't seen a dang horse yet. And I said, I'm gonna go see that race. So I dragged her up to the old Del Mar, right? Through those creaky boards and up until, and I got to see two dark bays, one with a small star, going head and head down the lane, and I was hooked. And I bought all the books that I could get my hands on, checked books out from the library down in Rancho Bernardo, and Steve Davidowitz, Andy Beyer books, and I just dove right into it. I wanted to learn everything about handicapping, everything about horses. And at that time, Chris, there was no inter-track wagering. If you were in Southern California, you either had to drive up to Santa Anita during Santa Anita meet, or you had to go down to Caliente and cross the border. Well, I did the Taco Bell thing. I ran for a border. Went down to Mexico and played at Agua Caliente a few times. I was making my own buyer figures. Loved it. And I just found it to be mentally incredibly challenging. So I was making my figures. I was watching the show at night. You're not from California, so people who listen from California would get it. At 8 o'clock at night on KUSI, there used to be the replay show from Santa Anita or Del Mar or Hollywood, wherever we were running. And I would record it, and it came on right after Hogan's Heroes. So you always get to watch Hogan's Heroes and then watch the replays. It was my early access to being able to watch replays. I started developing a pattern on how to go about doing things. In 1984, I read a book by James Quinn that's still out there called Handicapping in the Information Age. This is 1984. And wow, that's 30, what is that? 41 years ago? And he detailed in the book on how to approach racing by using computers or even notes taking and note cards and being able to maintain records that were that now we take for granted are available on every site, but back then they were not. So I had note cards on every trainer. I followed along what James Quinn talked about in that book on how to maintain and deal with the information that was from the track to be able to make better sound decisions at the window. At the same time, I met a trainer named Jack B. Haynes at Santa Anita. And to understand a little bit about how I got this, I was working as an investigator for a retail company. Actually, I was working for Pillsbury and later Cardo Holly Hale. For Pillsbury, I started out just working undercover at Horton Plaza, downtown San Diego. It was a brand new mall, about six levels, and smack in the middle of downtown. And at that point, was a bit sketchy, you know, where you could sit there at the Carl's Jr. across the street, who's now a Payless shoe store, and watch drug deals go down on the corner. And so I got trained because I didn't make it through the police academy. So I got trained in being a civilian working in a task force that would try to keep Horton Plaza from getting run over by crime. And we were pretty darn good at it. I mean, we probably in the 3 years I was there, we amassed up probably about 2,000 arrests. And I mean, they loved us. I mean, security loved us. The cops loved us. We did everything except basically carry a weapon. So I learned the art of attention to detail, because when you're doing what I was doing, is you needed to be able to identify individuals by their actions or how they looked or how they were. And I don't want to say profiling. I mean, guy would walk in and the first thing he would do, he would look around and check out the whole place. You knew he was up to something. So we had a state-of-the-art camera room. We could watch everything. And we basically ran the whole security department. And later on, I was one of the guys that worked with undercover officers, basically trained them on the floor. And so I learned about attention to detail, seeing little things that other people don't. And that has suited me very well in my next vocation. So I became an officer. I got promoted into a district position. I was running the whole entire area of the South Bay and the Lamo Mall, which was great for me. I got moved up to LA, lived in Whittier. And guess where I was going for lunchtime? Hollywood Park or Santa Anita, you know. And I would spend a couple of hours there because I was putting in 12, 14-hour days. And it would be my little escape from you know, chasing thieves and bad employees and management. And so I met first Robert Marshall was one of the first trainers I met. And then I met Jack B. Haynes, and Jack kind of took me under his wing. So what I did was, I was a glutton for punishment. I got up at 4:30 in the morning, got to Santa Anita at 5:30, worked with Jack on the backside in that first cement stable right next to the gate, right next to the gap that horses went on and off the track. I would walk hots, I would feel horses' legs, and Jack taught me well, you know. And after we get done, because he had a small stable, he had like four or five. So we'd sit outside and watch all the big horses coming on and off the track. And he had a kick, but he got a kick because I would watch a horse come off the track and I go, that's no chief for Mel Studi. Or Charlie Whittingham would bring a chestnut with a really small star, and I'd say that's Ferdinand. That's fairly old for Mesh Tenney. And I had a talent of being able to look at horses and identifying them by their looks. And I remember he used to get a kick. He'd go, he'd quiz me on who is that and who is that. And if I didn't know, eventually I'd find out. And next time I saw the horse, I would tell him who that is. So that attention to detail that I learned basically chasing crooks at Horton Plaza would really help me out. And also, I spent 12 weeks on the disabled list because I was chasing a couple of, I could say that illegals and we don't wear uniforms or anything. We basically stalked people. And I got thrown off the second floor in by the Nordstrom's there at Horton Plaza and shredded my ligaments and my ankle. I needed 12 weeks after surgery. Well, we were going to the track every day. You know, my brother, my good friend is like my brother, Mike Jackson was his name. And he had broken his fibula skiing a week before I hurt my leg. So we're both on crutches, driving up to Santa Anita all day long, playing the horses and then driving back. So it was quite fun. And having met Jack now I'm in L.A. And I learned a lot from him. I would beat him to the barn and I would go into every stall. We only had five horses and we would feel the legs and I would feel heat on a knee. I would feel the beginning of a tendon on a notch on a tendon. Had one filly called Beyond Her Means that loved to bite. I had to always be careful. She almost took a chunk out of my shoulder one day. So I learned a lot about horses. You know, I'd walk this big dumb colt named Fairway Phantom, and I'm walking him and he goes straight up in the air above me. I mean, way up above me. And he comes down right on my foot. And I remember Corey Black was on a horse for Whittingham going by and he goes, "Nice catch." And I'm sitting there about dying because my foot just got squished. But that was kind of my that was about 1988, 1989, right around the Sunday Silence era. And I got really a lot of experience being on the backside, watching horses. And Jack said, you know, you'd be good clocking. And I go, whatever, you know. I owned a couple of horses. I had some fun. Well, then Racing Times came around. And the Racing Times came around and I got hired by Jay Pridman. I got hired by Jay Pridman to be their, to do their charts, basically call charts, call the running of the races. So we can have, you know, beaten lanes and running lines. So that was really cool. You know, I learned how to do that. And at the same time, I had a meeting at Today's Racing Digest with a gentleman named Rick Lochner. And Rick said, you know what you could really do? You know what you would be really good at is clocking. If you go clocking, because at that time, if you remember the Racing Times, it was owned by Murdoch. Who owned the Racing Times? It was a Mirror Times Corporation. The guy ended up dying he fell off a yacht or something, but there was some talk about he had appropriated, pension funds money to make the business go and he had more money. So I remember in February, it was pretty close to Valentine's Day. I bet a horse for Leonard Dorfman. He won the race, got DQ'd and got the call that we were done and shutting down. How about that? Yeah, you talk about a double whammy, right? Get taken down. And I was more worried about getting taken down and disqualified than I was about the job. So I had met with Rick and he had told me you need to clock because you're going to be good at it. So at the start of, I think this happened before the whole thing with Racing Times went under, but I started going to Hollywood for the Hollywood Fall Meet and just started going out there and clocking. That's how I got started. And the first horse I really liked was a horse named Star of the Crop. He was a Glen Hill farm for Willard Proctor, had broken his maiden first time out. And he had done it in just generic fashion. He had big wraps on, you know. I mean, it looked like if you would have really taken a that race as a telltale, you never would have liked him if he was, you know, next time out. But he had a really big work at Hollywood Park the first week I was there, and I recognized him too. That's the funny thing. I recognized him who he was, didn't have any wraps on, looked smooth, did everything. I think he worked like 47 and change out in a minute. And he's entered in the preview stakes, which is was the prep for the Hollywood Futurity at the end of the meet. This is 1991. Well, he wins that. He pays 7-2. He wins that. So obviously learned that Willard Proctor will run horses short first time out and then get new improved second time out. And then there was this claimant, this big gray horse for Julio Canani, worked 47 flat. And, you know, Julio was like, you know, a guy you had to follow over there, you know, in California. He was really good with those kind of horses, and the horse wins. And I'm thinking, hey, Chris, this is an easy game. I got this all figured out, you know. So I learned a lot, you know, by trial and error. And I also learned that there's certain entities that don't like you clocking because it gets into their, you know, they're not getting a piece of your action, so to speak. So there was a bit of a battle there where they didn't want me to clock. The clockers weren't trying to get me out of there for not clocking, but they couldn't because I was Racing Times. So with the Racing Times there, they hired me, and my first workout report was on December 26th at Santa Anita. Opening day. And that's how we got started. And then, you know, obviously Racing Times went under. I went to work for the Digest, and the rest kind of snowballed from there. And here I am talking to you.
So when you first started out, you were clocking officially like the clocker for the Racing Times. Or are you just clocking on your own?
I was clocking on my own. And then I pitched them on a workout report. I just went in and said, here's the workout report for opening day. And they looked at it and said, oh, this is great. And, you know, and there was pushback. There was pushback from private clockers that didn't want this to see it in the paper. There were people that were going up to the people that were selling the paper and basically threatening them, you know, to not have this published. And to be honest, can I just say this? I don't give a shit. You know, you want to come over to me and tell me I can't do something? Guess what? I'm going to do it even better now, you know? And so I kind of got into this, into doing the clocking. You know, there wasn't any, you know, hey, God bless you, son. Take care of, you know, do a good job. You know, no, there was like people just like telling you need to stop this, you know. You can't do this. You're killing us. You know, well, too bad. Find another job if you don't like it, you know? So, but that I got to really, and coming from a position that I had been in as an investigator and somebody that went out, you know, I found this to be just right up my alley. You know, I wasn't afraid to go out on a 250-pound guy who I was going to take down. So why would I be afraid of you with a stopwatch? So they're kind of picking on the wrong person, so to speak. You know,
were they upset because you were publishing it were in cut to a broader audience through the Racing Times, whereas they were either private clockers or had some special clocker report they sold exclusively to a small clientele? Is that kind of who was pushing back?
I was basically, well, first of all, you know, what the Clockers did back then is that they would get people come to them for information, and they would give them the information in exchange for tickets or money. So the guy, you know, say, okay, I'll put 200 to win. Well, now what incentive is for a player to go to a Clocker and say, hey, give me information and I'll pay you, when they can buy it for $19.95 or $4.95 or $9.95? There is no incentive for them. There still are people that'll do that. They're still stuck in the medieval times too, you know, and dark ages, because they'll still do that. But, you know, it was hurting their business from being able to people to buy tickets for them, because they thought they had a monopoly. Well, guess what? Bruno got into it and busted the monopoly up.
Well, I have to say a couple things. One is, you're the first person that made a Hogan's Heroes reference on the show. When I was a kid, I liked that show. So
I know nothing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, right. You should be naming your horse after the sergeant there, or Colonel Plank. Yeah. Yeah, so that was
sergeant
a great show.
Schultz.
Sergeant Schultz, yes,
and Colonel Plank. Every now and then, and you get to watch it, you know, and you kind of laugh about it and going, God, you know, Hogan, you know, was quite the character.
Yeah, that show was something. And the James Quinn book you talked about, I have it on my bookshelf, The High-Tech Handicapping in the Information Age. So that was kind of a groundbreaking book at the time.
If you look at that book and you see the way we designed our site, there's very, very many similarities. You know, there's a lot of similarities. I remember reading that and thinking, if I was, you know, because in 1984, I mean, there was no computers. You could get a computer, an IBM computer. I bought one in 1987 with remember the old floppy disk? I mean, literally floppy disk, you know? And, you know, nobody knew anything about them. I started that early trying to keep records. And I used to be able to build my own graph of my figures on graph sheets on those floppy disks. So I have to say, I started in the tech age a little bit earlier than most people.
So let's talk about now. That's sort of how you got to the point where you became a Clocker. So tell us a little bit about what's the morning for a Clocker. I mean, what's the process you go through? What's it like? I mean, I've been out there with Clockers before in the mornings, and I have no idea how you guys do it. It's just, there's horses all over the place, and somehow you got to know what horse is what and when they're starting their work and timing the fraction. I mean, how do you do all that? I mean, how do you stay organized?
Not being an official Clocker for the track, I don't get calls. I mean, I might have a trainer call me, hey, and say, hey, Bruno, will you clock my horse for me? You know, he's going to broke 5/8. I never ask who that horse is. I never do. Because you know what? When you ask somebody something, you're telling them you don't know. And if you don't know, they can take advantage of you. You know, and also, this is the way trainers speak. Hey, you know, Bruno, I got that colt. That colt's going to go 3/8. You know, I'll put the boy on him, you know, and see what he does. You know what he did. You know, I mean, that's how Clockers, trainers talk. So I don't even now to this day, when we do the videos, I do everything off of markings. Everything is off markings. There's no set list. You know, you've got two bays. You've got to figure them out. You got to separate them by one's got a left hind under and the other one's got a right front over. You got to figure it out which one is which by looking at their leg markings, their face markings, the way they move. So a lot of, and this is one of the most interesting part of this game. There's a lot of people that think they know everything about racing. And they'll come to the track and they'll look at me and go, hey, Bruno, you're Bruno, right? I go, yeah. Where do I get the list of who's working? And I kind of look at them, and I've gotten in trouble a couple of times because I've been a real smart ass about it. There is no list. There is no list that says here, first, second, third, fourth, fifth that went. No. The only thing you get is at the end of the day, there's a tab that's got all the horses on. So there's this mentality. And I've had this over, I've been doing this for 30-something years. I've had this at least once a year happen to me, where a guy walks up and says, where's that list? You're holding it for me. You're not showing it to me. No, there is no effing list. You know, I'm watching that horse turn for home. to Beino Marks with a left hind that looks like he's got a left hind and maybe he's got a right front under and he's working for Steve Sherman. That's how you figure it out. You put it all down, and then at the end of the day, you basically get to tab and you match up horses by and I have a staff that is solely that his sole job and job description is to provide me with every workout tab from across the country on a daily basis. That includes trainer and markings on a horse. There's nobody else that does that. And if you find somebody, Chris, let me know, because I think they're full of shit.
So is that what you're doing? You're jotting down whatever character. If you might recognize a horse spot on because you've seen him, but if you haven't, you're marking down, you know, what's the barn, what's the markings, and then you can figure it out. So that's kind of what you're
yeah, you have like have a notebook or something. You have
something?
To do it on the fly.
Yeah.
You know, usually I have kind of the way it works is you pick up a horse at the 5/8. Now he's on the other side of the track. I don't care if I have good binoculars, but I usually don't only have one horse going at a time. I usually am watching 3-4 horses at one time. So now I've got to make sure that I've got this Chad Brown coming, a team coming around. The inside has got a star with a left hind with Irad on board, and the outside horse is a bay with no marks, maybe a left hind. So I note that. Then the second set's coming through. I've got about 6 to 8 seconds to look at the horse, look at the markings, look at the trainer. I mean, look at the trainer's pad. Look at the equipment. The equipment is very, very important. And jot all that down. How the horse is going with all the splits, catching them on the gallop out. Boom, on to the next. So it's not like, oh, well, let me check the Chad Brown tab. Let me see. Oh, this could be. No, you can't do that. You do that, you miss 20.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that. I mean, because there's like multiple horses working at the same time. So how do you possibly keep track of all that?
Some people are good at chaos. I'm good at handling chaos. Other people are not. I can handle chaos. And this comes from me working as an investigator and undercover. Because you have to deal with chaos in those situations. Because you're watching two people. You got your partner. You and your partner got to communicate on who you're watching. And then you got to set it up to make sure you're in the right spot if you're going to take them down and who's going to be where. And then you got to negotiate all the other people that are involved around there that are clueless on what you're doing. So I learned how to handle chaos. I'm very good in chaotic situations because I can figure it out.
Best analogy is because I was totally impressed when anytime I've seen clockers operate, because I think like no way I could ever do that. Kind of reminds me like when I go to Vegas at the craps table and you know you've got the guy running the table and he's moving chips left and right and. You know, all keep track of who won bets and lost bets. I mean, how in the world do they keep track of all that and not screw it up? That's what it reminds me of when I see a clocker out there with these horses, you know, running around the track all over the place. You're trying to keep track of things like markings and trainers and stuff. Just amazing.
It's become like second nature to me. It's second nature. I was gone from Del Mar for 10 years since 2011. And I came back the last 2 years and within a day I was back in the saddle again. It was not hard at all. Which leads to, you know, with doing the videos and everything, I get people going, oh, I'm really good at workouts. So I can look at a workout and tell you something. And I'm laughing at them. I'm literally laughing at them because they have no idea. If you were to take those guys who think they're geniuses watching a video and put them out on the track and say, okay, go ahead, do the same thing now. And sit back. I probably have my coffee and go, okay, let me know when you're done.
Well, yeah. I absolutely know that there's
no chance. No chance. Not at all. Because you know what? They look at one video and they can go back and see the replay, do this and that. But also, I'll tell you why.
You can't ask the horses to stop and go back and do that again.
No, I tried to. They don't give me the middle hoof. No, but the thing is that when you're watching videos, you think you know, oh, this horse worked 59. Well, What about the rest of the horses at work that day? You have no context on how that horse worked compared to the entire tab. I'll give you a great example. August 23rd at Del Mar this year. So the gate works have been really fast at Del Mar. But if you're nitpicking or cherry picking on the videos and only picking out the fast times, which most Nimrods do, they go, oh, this horse 59. I need to see it. But you know what? You didn't watch the horse that went 101, you know, on the official time. They really went 59-2. You're not going to watch him because you're just looking at the time and going, oh, he didn't work any good. So number one, you're not looking at the entire context of the entire day. So August 23rd. So we had gate works all day that day. And I'm going to read to you some of the gate work times that I had. This is from the first set. 47.1 a minute, 47.1 a minute, 47.4. 46.3, 59.2, 46.3 a minute 2, 47 out minute 4, 34 flat, 46.4, 101.2. Then we go to the second break and we've got 47.2. And then we go to the last set. And this is the last break of the day. 47.3, 59.1, 59.2, 58.4, 58.4, 58.1, 58.1. All of a sudden, in that set, the truck sped up tenfolds. So on one, I had 2, 4, 6, 8, had about 10 horses work after the third set. And I'll read them to you again, 59.1, 59.2, 58.4, 58.4, 58.1, 58.1. I mean, they were flying. And anybody that picked up the work with Coco Slew and I think it's a horse named Parley something for Sadler. And they went 46-1, 58-4, and 12-3, and 13-2. They're going, ooh, look what I got here. This horse worked great. But they didn't go and look at all the other horses that worked that day. They have no context of what happened. So when they run, they're like, oh, I got something. This horse worked fantastic. Oh, got to see this video. But they didn't go look at the Baltus team that went 58-1. They didn't go look at the Mendez and I think, I'm not sure who, Miller, Mulholland Drive that went 59-1 with Grace by Faith with Mandela. They didn't watch the O'Neill team. You know, every horse that was going 3/8, at least 3/8, out of the gate was going 34 and change. Here's the 3/8 times just from the other day. Horses working, whether they went longer or not, but this was a 3/8 time. 34-4, 34-1, 34-1, 33-4, 35 flat, 34-4, 34-2. So that day was, you just take every single gate work and you just go, this is an anomaly. They're all working way too fast. I can't put as much stock,
unknown caller,
as much stock into any of these times and any of these works that I've seen today. But if you're going on a video and you are clueless of what happened that entire day, you're coming up with watching one of those and you're like, ooh, 46-3. And also, I did the math on it. On August 23rd, there was 25% of the work tab went faster than 59.4. Chris, 25% went faster than 59.4. So if you're watching videos and you are not watching all the other works from that day, you're completely going to, you're lost. You're going to lose because you're going to pick a horse that worked fast and you think you're going to something and you're not.
So that makes a lot of sense. And that kind of leads to the question, when you are watching a workout, other than the times and trying to make sure you put those in context, what are you actually looking for when you're watching the horse? I mean, in terms of, you know, what is it that distinguishes, you know, a good work from a bad work? And let's just like start with a horse that's just, you know, working solo. What are you looking for in terms of the rider or the horse?
Reacting to the horse. The one problem that you find with people is they don't know, but they want to tell you they know. And sometimes I watched a horse that he was working in company and he was down inside of another horse. And the outside horse was winning every single one. I didn't like the outside horse. I didn't like the way he moved. I didn't like that. Yeah, but he's winning the drill. And people are going, ooh, he's running good. Well, the inside horse didn't want to be inside. Asmussen was putting him inside every time because that horse hated to be inside. He didn't look like he was climbing, not doing things right. Guess what? He works in from the gate by himself. And the horse looked like a different animal. Just a completely different animal the way he was moving. He does not handle being in competition. Competition, being inside, is just kryptonite to him. But he put them all by himself. He looks great. It's a good-looking horse. They spent a lot of money on him. But when you get him in competition, he falls apart. So I'm watching horses react with other horses. And that is the key, is watching horses the way that, again, I'm using my visual skills that I learned in an early age working undercover, you know, for this. I'm watching for horses to do things that will tell me who they are.
So give an example, like what you'd be watching for, something you might see that would give you some insight into a horse, you know, some examples of that, the little subtle things that you're picking up.
Like the one I just told you, you know, the horse is great by himself, and then he gets in company and he starts drifting. He starts moving about. He starts be kind of sloppy. That's a horse that mentally is not handling dealing the competition. Then, or you get the horse that's completely lazy, laid back, like, okay, I'm going to go 49. Here's what I'm doing. I'm just doing it easy. All of a sudden you put him in company or you put him out of the gate, and they just show you a different dimension to their mind. It's about how they handle it with their mind. It's got nothing to do with time. And I'm going to say this to your listeners. Stop paying attention to nothing but time. Time is only matters when you're in jail. It has nothing to do with time. But I hear all the guys on TV all the time. Oh, this horse says 3, 4, 47 and twos and a 59 and four, three bullet works. Oh, you know what? You do that, that horse ain't running a step. You have too many bullets, you shoot yourself in the foot. You cannot have horses going boom, 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 fast, 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 fast. There'll be nothing left. That's why horsemen don't care about time. Horsemen want the horses to get fit, conditioned. The fitness is important to them. So if they go 49, 101 and 2, out in 14, they're happy with that because they don't want that horse to do any more than he has to. Because if you do that, it ends up costing you in the long run. Another example, right before the race, there's a few really good trainers or high percentage trainers, let's say, that love to have their horses go 46 and change at 59 at Saratoga 6 days before the race. I mean, that's insane. And you know what? A lot of times I won't give that horse a big work. I'll give that horse a 3-star and say, yeah, he worked good, but he's coming back really quick. And a lot of the times these guys get stuck in these ruts with these decisions that they make. And what happens, and you're sitting back going, if that horse runs with after that work 6 days later, he's a grade one horse. But I'm not putting my money on him because every clocker in the world saw it. Every guy is going to have B pluses and A minuses. Oh, let me, you know, those horses get hammered at the windows. There was a day at Saratoga, the first part of the meet, and I'm pulling up the horse right now. Horse's name was Spa Prospector. For Tom Amos. I think he's going to run in a 2-year-old stake coming up. Last time it ran was on it ran second time out at Saratoga on July 12th. And I remember the horse coming in. He had come in from Churchill and he had run seventh, but he had some big works at Churchill Downs. I knew the horse was talented. And it was out of a mare called Pray for Leslie, or I remember it was an Al Stahl Jr. horse that won first time out. And she had some issues and she didn't make it as a racehorse. In fact, let me see what she did as a racehorse. She had run three times and won twice, but she was a Bernardini out of a Mizzen Mass mare. And so Spot Prospector, I knew, could win. Well, there was another horse in the race, Ginger Ale. And she had a pretty good work over at Keeneland, but I wasn't sold on her. I wasn't sold on her. She had a big gate work over there and the DRF was all over her. They made her down to 6-5. I knew that she wasn't all that. And I loved Spot Prospector, and I got 1340 to win on her. So I've actually learned that I need to know who people like and who people want to and who people are touting, because when you do know that, when you do know what the horses are being touted, the horses with the B pluses and the A minuses, because I deal with stars. I don't deal with that other crap. Ask me about that later, too. Ask me about the rating system. So, I need to know because it shows up on the tote board. Now, this is the thing that drives me crazy about horse players. Most horse players don't know what parimutuel betting is. Or if they do, they've got amnesia. Because you've got players taking workout reports and passing them around like it's water at a 4th of July barbecue. They're passing them around, Xerox and more copies and Kinko's, sending them to everybody. What are you doing? You're betting off of those and you want everybody to know what you know? That's retarded in my in mentality. You need to be committed if you're a horse player. Committed to like the OTB. Stay there, don't ever come out, Because if you're sitting there and you've got information, why in the world would you give it to everybody else? That's how you get 6-5s. That's how you lose, because you are giving everybody the same information you have. You have no advantage. It blows my mind that the mentality. Well, you know what? I will say this. Recently in society, we made stupidity a brand. And it's always, to me, mind-boggling how people don't think things through anymore. And in this case, here you have everybody jumping all over the B-plus on Ginger Ale, and Spot Prospector sitting at 5 to 5.5 to 1. I was on with Bill Finley and Dave Johnson, like a half an hour before the race, and I said, I love Spot Prospector. And we're going to get odds because they're going to bet on Ginger Ale, because I knew what other horses were being touted. And that's another part of the game. You got to understand who your competition is. Your competition is the people that are betting against you, not the racetrack, not the jockeys, not the trainer. It's the people that are betting against you. And if you're just going to look at everything that everybody else is betting, you have no advantage whatsoever. What I do is when I watch horses, I watch these horses and not from a betting standpoint. I don't look at them and go, oh, I want to bet that one. How many times have you heard that, Chris? People say, oh, I want to bet that horse. Well, you know what? If you don't do your work and you do your handicapping and then decide whether you're going to bet it or not, or look at a price before making that decision, you're insane. You're doing you absolutely have no idea what you're doing gambling. And not you, I'm talking general. And you're just out there trying to pat yourself on the back from being, masters of the universe. So in a lot of ways, handicappers have really, I think if you take handicappers IQ 20 years ago, racing IQ, and you compare it to now, it's, you know, it's like falling off a deep cliff, because they've all been bombarded by all this stuff about, oh, you need to, you know, and you and I have had good conversations. Oh, the price has to be right, or this has to be that. Oh, and my favorite one is 20 minutes before post, the first odds pop up. And you picked Christopher Larmy.
Good choice.
Christopher Larmy opens up at 9-5. 25 minutes before post. The analyst says, I can't bet that horse. They're live on TV. I can't bet that horse. I can't bet him at 9-5. I'm going to go over to Scotty. Scotty is going to be my horse now. He's 6-1. So you know what happens? It happens all the time. Scotty gets bet down to 5-2 by the end of the time. And Christopher rises up to 5-1. Christopher wins. Scotty ends up the track. And the guy that liked Christopher at the beginning now is betting on Scotty, gets nothing. I just find that to be deliciously humorous. Deliciously. It's like having a sfogliatella from downtown San Diego. I mean, it's just, you just watch it, you go, what are you thinking? You know, I want to do the Dr. Phil. I don't know, I don't care too much for him. What were you thinking? You know?
You did pretty good, Dr. Phil. That was good. Good imitation. You know,
but, you know, the mentality of horse players, you can use their own mentality against them because you know that's what they're going to gravitate to. And that's how you get your prices. You know, you don't try to fit a square peg into a round hole. You know, well, everybody likes that horse. I'm going to play, you know, no, I can't do that. When I come across doing that, I don't bet. I have incredible control about wagering. I don't bet. If I don't get what I think I deserve to get, I'm not going to play. I'm not going to give you my money. I'm not going to, and it's not about giving you my money. Is I don't want to feel like a, you know, nowadays it's funny because nowadays you create enemies by simply showing that you're not a dipshit. You know that, right, Chris?
You can elaborate, but I think you're talking about social media probably here.
No, I'm right? Talking about the world today. You create enemies by basically not being a dumbass. And it's true. You know, people love people that they feel they're one of them. So I don't want to feel like I'm one of them. I don't want to feel like I'm another dip betting horses at the track. I want to feel like I'm accomplishing something. And I think a lot of people don't take that. You hear them talk, I want to gamble. I want to play that horse. No, you shouldn't. You know, it's not about wanting to play the horse. Is the horse going to win? No, I want to play it. You know, or I want to play against. That's another that drives me nuts. I want to play against that horse. Why? Well, because I didn't like his race last time out. Or I don't like the jockey. Or he's my favorite ones. I don't like the trainer. Oh, I don't like the owner. I don't want the owner to win. You get a lot of people that deal with all that emotional baggage that they deal with. And you know, one of my biggest things that I love to do, having sat in the press box at Santa Anita for 20 years, is watch people in front of me talk about how they didn't like, oh, I don't like that guy. That guy's a schmear. Oh, I don't like that guy. That guy's a douche. You know, and they would bet and they would bet against them because they didn't like them. I love to bet on somebody I don't like, because if I win on somebody I don't like, that tells me that I am not an unjust. I'm a horse player that is going to look at, I'm a partial. Am I using the right word? I'm a partial judge when I.
Impartial. Play. Impartial.
Impartial. Again,
yeah.
I am not going to allow my personal feelings and baggage to affect myself if I don't like a trainer, but I think his horse is going to win. And then I do my favorite thing. I'll text that trainer and go, hey, congratulations. Well done. You know? Confuses the hell out of people. Go, I thought he didn't like me, you know? But the whole thing is you got to get rid of the emotional baggage. And it's the same thing in the morning. I got to get rid of the emotional baggage. I got to pick up horses and get a decision on horses. I can't worry about, I don't like that guy. I like that guy. I like that horse. I don't like that horse. You know, I've had horses that have changed my mind the way they were doing things. So one of the biggest, you know, one of my favorite commercials is some of the Peyton Manning commercials when he goes, I'm not only Peyton Manning, I'm not Peyton Manning, I'm motivating Manning. You know, I mean, some of the things that he says are really funny, but they make sense because you got to go in and look at things from a perspective of how you're going to be able to achieve what you want to do. And that's cash a ticket. Now, whether you got personal feelings about a guy or somebody or a writer or this or that, it shouldn't have anything to do with it. If Irad, you don't like Irad, you don't like Jose, I love Jose. Irad, you know, whatever. You know, I love Jose. I think they're phenomenal writers, but I have no problem betting on them. And you get guys going, oh, I can't bet that guy. I can't bet that guy. You know? Well, you know what? All you're doing is being a child. You're being an 8-year-old child, you know, because somebody took your toy away. You know, when you approach things, you got to approach them from the standpoint of, here's the facts and here I'm going to play. A lot of players like to say, I like that horse. And then they're going to make a case for it. Which is not the way you do things. You don't go and say, you look at the horse and you do all your work on it. And then you say, okay, you know what? I can see what this horse is okay. I'll give you a great example of something that happened to me. Last year, 2024, I got a call from a farm manager and a owner of Windstar. One of the guys, the big guys, Elliot Walden. And he asked me about, he says, hey, would you do me a favor? Actually, his publicist got a hold of me. And he says, would you clock Heartland 23 maiden win and tell us what he wants furlongs in? Because he ran 5.5 in 103-2. It was his only race ever. He was a beautiful son of Justify, half brother to Classic Empire. And I didn't know what they wanted me to do it for, but I did it. And I got about a 109 and change. And Elliot told me, he goes, we're going to make him a stud. You know, I think, you know, if White Clint's Music can do it, if Malibu Moon can do it, why can't this guy do it? He's so well bred and he was a good horse. He just got hurt. So I said, okay, I'll put together a whole YouTube thing. And it's on YouTube. And I went through and I systematically went through all. And at that time, I had no opinion. No opinion. You know? And I went and looked at him physically. I watched his yearling video where he was walking. And then I watched his workouts. And then I watched his race. And I watched it from overhead, from the head on and everything. I slowed it down. By the time I got done, I went, this horse is going, it's awesome. He's got a great way of going. He moves good through the knees. He's well put together. He's a big, good-looking son of Justify, you know? And they ended up standing a stud for $10,000. And I took three mares to him. So my whole point was I was able to put together a YouTube video that actually maybe wasn't for anybody but me to see what that horse was all about. You read workout reports today, especially in Southern California, and they are brutal on horses. They are brutal. They knock horses, they knock what they do. And I don't, you know, oh, he's awful, C plus and B minus. They don't appreciate these animals. You got to appreciate horses for what they do. Now, that horse may not have worked great, but you know what? All of them ain't going to be grade one winners. They all ain't going to go to the Breeders' Cup. Some will be running for maiden 20, maiden 32. You got to adjust to your mentality to what you're seeing. So a lot of times people read these reports They're like, oh, you know, they don't like anything. They never like anything. They hate everything. Because you know what? You can't hold it against them if they hate everything. And that is one of the problems that I see with a lot of these workout reports that are out there. You've read my stuff for years. You've been a subscriber for a long time. If you ever felt like I was really rough or knocked a horse incessantly.
No, but I wouldn't mind if you didn't think the horse looked good, you didn't give it a good rating. Which I mean,
but again,
you didn't disparage the horses. No.
I mean, the ratings basically tell you what you thought of the work. It doesn't mean that the horse sucks or he's no good. He's terrible. No, just means that he's not coming into the race the way you want him to come into the race. And that is another problem. People just look at ratings. I got in an argument with one guy. I'm not going to mention, you know, Scotty's name. But he told me, he goes, I don't have time to read the comments. Yeah, I just look at the rating. You know, we went back and forth on it. He's dead wrong. Because sometimes when you're rating a horse, you quite don't have an idea what that horse is. But I'll sprinkle in, if I think there's some positives, I'll throw them in there. Do I think he's going to run first time out? I don't know. And if I give him a 2-star, you know, I write this a lot now, Chris. Don't discount because of time. Don't hold it against this horse because he worked 38. Because you have to do that because people just look at the time and make up their own mind. I'm at dinner at Maurizio's Trattoria here in Encinitas during Del Mar. And I'm having dinner with 3 owners. They just bought a horse privately out of Churchill. And the horse has been back here for about 3 weeks over in Brian Corner's barn. And on August 1st, his name popped up that he worked at Turfway 102 and 2. Obviously, it's not that horse. Obviously, that's a mistake. Obviously, you know, the horse is over at Del Mar with Brian Corner. It isn't this horse. You know what the owner was set there? The owner was all torn up. Why? Not because they gave a time back at Turfway, because he worked 102 and 2. I said, dude, it wasn't him. So what are you worried about? My horse doesn't work 102 and 2. What are you talking about? It wasn't him. You know, and the guy was all torn up and ticked off that they gave his horse a slow time at Turfway when he's in the barn at Brian Corner's barn at Del Mar.
So talk about then, you know, if you're a horse player and you have comments or grades or ratings, however you want to describe it, you know, how do you use that? How do you put that in context? How should you factor that into your handicapping of that horse in a race? I mean,
when I like a horse and I give it a 4-star work, what I'm really telling you, Chris, is take a look at this horse. It's simple. That's it. Take a look at this horse. This horse is doing well, and he's coming into the race right.
So what about if you have a 2-star rating on a horse? What does that mean? How should I use that information? Some comments.
Not a bad horse. I just don't see him as a horse that is coming into the race the way I want to see a horse coming into the race. That doesn't mean he's bad.
Right.
It doesn't mean I got to rant. I got to call him awful or this. He's just not coming into the race the way I wanted to see him.
So let's talk about some specific kind of cases. So let's start with sort of the traditional place where people rely on clockers a lot. And that's with, you know, first time starters, young horses, they're really lightly raced.
That is a myth. That's to me, first of all, that is a myth. And sometimes I take it a little bit like a backhanded compliment. Like when people walk up to me and say, who do you like are the first time starters? I don't want to know anything else. First time starters. Like, what do you think? I'm just sitting out here looking at nothing but first time starters. How about if I got a horse that I think is really coming into the race really, really well, whether he's not a first time starter or not. But their mentality is they think they know better if they've got past performances in front of them. And maybe they do. But in my point is, why don't you hear me?
No, and we'll get to those examples. I didn't want to just say that's the only place. But the thing about first-time starters, you don't have any other information. So, you know, you don't have any past performance in terms of actual races on the course. So, you know, the workouts carry that much more weight because there's so little of, you know, additional information. That's all I was trying to convey.
Right, but you're one of the most cerebral handicappers I've met. You are.
Well, thank you.
There are a bunch of them that, you know, they're looking for bullet works and fast works. That's all they care about. And bullet works are manipulated by most official track crews.
Most. So explain that, what you mean by that. So explain what you mean.
All right. About 2016, 2017. Michael Moreno has got a team working at Saratoga. He's got a big, black, good-looking curling colt with a generic-looking bay with blinkers on. Well, they go 47, and the curling colt starts behind, blows by him, goes 47 out in a minute, too. Freezing. Beautiful. The horse that finished second went 48. Just didn't look good at all. Clockers gave the curling colt a minute three. Not that half mile. They gave it a minute three, which was like seventh out of 32. And that he did that on the gallop out. The 48 horse, the donkey that finished second, had the bullet work in 48. They gave him 48, which was the bullet work of the day. The donkey got the bullet work. The good one got the minute three, seventh out of 36. I remember sitting there because 2 weeks later, that same donkey worked 50, and on the gallop out, he tripped over his own feet and went down. He was favored first time out, for Christ's sake, because of that bullet. I don't think he almost ever won. He was finished back of the pack. He was no good. But because people saw that bullet, they thought that horse is fast. And he was a donkey. So official clockers know this. They know you're all looking for bullet works. They're not going to give them to you. I'll give you another example. Rudy Rodriguez worked a mare. 5/8 in a minute, too. I looked up after she worked. She worked all out under the whip, Chris. All out. There was nothing left. I look up after she galloped out, and she's being vanned off. Okay? So obviously, something went wrong. She got the bullet that day. So my whole point is, they're aware of what you're looking at. And they're using it against you. So when you're looking at workout reports, I wouldn't be looking at an effing rating. I would be looking to see if there's anything different than what they put out on paper. If I had a gate work in 58-4 out in 111-2 and they gave it a 101, then you know, you know, if you read, you knew. But people don't do that. They just look at the rating. Great story about a first-time starter. I have had more big scores on horses doing something 6-8 weeks, maybe a month before they ran. A month before they ran, and everybody forgot about them. There was a horse for Wayne Catalano I'm going to be exact because people can go look it up. The horse's name was Gentleman's Bet. He was a half hour's colt for Wayne Catalano. And he debuted on, I was right, January 5th, 2012 at Gulfstream. However, doing the Keeneland meet that October, prior October, I had watched that horse go 32-4, 44-4 out of the gate. Worked awesome. Came back on the day after the Breeders' Cup, 2011, and worked 59 out of the gate at Churchill. They gave him 101, but he went 59. Now, he's not showing up any entries. Shows up on January 5th, 2012 at Gulfstream Park. I'm sitting there with my partner. I put it on the sheet in big, bold letters, red. I mean, you couldn't have missed it if you're standing, you know, at the top of the stretch and looked at my sheet at the wire. So it was a full field of 12. And sat there and I said, I think we're going to get a price today. So we're sitting in the paddock and it's 15-1. And the work's coming in. They weren't bad. It was a 47-4 out of the gate. It was a 48. I knew exactly what Wayne Catalano was doing. Wayne knew that horse could run. He knew he went 44-4 at Keeneland. He went a 59. And he knew he could run. Now he doesn't have to work them fast. And he also told me after the race, Bruno, every time I got this horse to work big, he came up with a little problem. I had to back off. So that's why he said, okay, I'm not going to. He's fit. I know he's fast. I'm just going to do enough to get him into the race and go from there. So he's working 48, 47-4, nothing spectacular into that Gulfstream race. Joe Rocco is on him. I just kept going back to the window and betting more. He went off at $33.70 to one. He won by 7.25. Destroyed him. And I remember us tweeting it out that we just had this horse, you know, pay 60, what do you pay? $69. And at the same time, there's the guy from the DRF tweeting out of all the information that we got into the paddock, the longest shot on the board wins. Well, the second longest shot on the board wins. Well, no duh, because you had none of the information. You basically, I watched these clockers. They go around in the paddock area asking trainers if they like the horse. For the life of me, I've never gone around the paddock asking a trainer if he likes his horse, ever. And if I did that, I should be retiring or quit the game. But this was a great example of knowing what we had there and being confident in what we had seen and not allowing it to basically talk you off that horse. You knew if you just knew what you saw. And the funny thing, Chris, I had a couple of people write me after the race. Oh, I saw you had all that red on that horse. I didn't know. I thought you were goofing around. I mean, and hence I came up with a saying, you can walk the horse player to the window, but you can't make him bet the winner. But that's one of the great examples that you have. You know, I had one of my own horses that I bred, Officer Quigley. If you went and watched his works on our videos that we had, he was fast. He was working 47 under a hammerlock. His gates were good. Went off and paid $22 to win. Because people want to have the first-time starter that's training good match up with the statistics. This is the other dumbbell story that handicappers do. Well, you know what? This horse is training really good, but the trainer is only 5%. You know what? Either use one or the other. Use one or the other F and other. Don't use both. Don't try to combine the two. It doesn't work. Because when a trainer has a good horse, he knows what to do with it. Back in the 90s, I used to be on the Roger Stein show. And I had been watching a horse from the Jerry Dutton barn. The horse's name was Card Connection. And I'm going to give you the date specifically to that. Card Connection was his name. Now, at the time, Jerry was not prolific with first-time starters. And on February 6, 1994, the horse debuted for Jerry Dutton. And he was running them for $32,000. He trained them in front of horses, behind horses, outside of horses, inside of horses. He was doing something with that horse in the morning that he was not doing with anybody else. All the other horses were 5/8 by themselves, five, you know, but he was working this 3/4 out of the gate. He was doing things in a much different scenario. And I noticed that. I picked up on that. I was like, wait a minute. He put him inside last time out. Now he's outside. Oh, the time before that, he had him behind horses coming in. He likes this horse. Horse went to the lead, never looked back. And he paid 5-1. He paid 12-20. And I got more. I remember this was like in the second race. And I got to the track that day. And on the way up to the press box, I got stopped 3-4 times. What are you thinking? Why are you giving out a horse from a trainer that doesn't win with first-time starters? You're nuts. You don't know what you're talking about. Because people were looking at statistics and matching it up to the works instead of saying, this horse can run. This guy has got Gary Stevens on him. This guy knows what he's doing. And I don't care what the statistics say. This horse is going to run well. And sure shit did. So when a lot of times I hear about clockers like this one, and I kind of roll my eyes because horse players would trip over a winner if it didn't have all the bells and whistles, or that guy from the airport with the two yellow, orange things waving them in. So when I tell people to read my comments, they need to read the comments and worry about the rating later. Because I will give you a nugget. I will tell you straightforward if I like a horse or not. So on, was it Wednesday? Was it Friday? A horse for, oh, it's Fun DMC, for Randy Morse. And I'm going to read you my comment on the horse, okay?
Okay.
I'm pulling it up, so forgive me. All right, he's a spun-to-run two-year-old that ran on Friday, September 12th. Here's my comments. I had 2 4-star works on the horse. Worked well with speed in 22-3, 34-2, 47-1. Morse is very good and best kept secret at CD. He fires and gets prices. That's a pretty strong endorsement.
Is this a first-time starter? Okay.
Yes. And on the 21st of August, I had another comment. Spun DMC caught the eye for Morse with Hush It Honey in a quick 23, 34, 47, 2 minute flat. Two-year-old was best holding a head in front of a multiple winner. You think that horse went off at 10-1. It went off at 10-1. They're betting all these other horses. The guy on CD at Churchill Downs on the television. Well, he worked by himself. I didn't know what to do with, you know, Jane Elliott was riding, so it confused the hell of a lot of people. I knew that horse was good. I picked him on top, got $22 for it. But that's because people are not paying attention. They're looking at a rating. They're going, oh, yeah, but Jane Elliott's riding. Again, you're looking at statistics and you're not looking at what the horse is. Look at the horse. That's what's going to make you win or lose. Not the statistics, not the odds, just who that horse is. So when I say read the comments, I'm wanting you to take a little extra time, because I am taking the extra time to write comments and to tell you whether I like the horse or not, for you to show the respect and read it, because it's going to help you. Shocker, right, Chris?
Okay, well, you're saying the most important thing, it's always the horse. That's what's going to win the race. The jockeys don't win the race. The trainer doesn't win the race. The statistics don't win the race. It's the horse that wins the race. And that's what you're focused on.
Yes. Because Christopher, when's the last time you saw a jockey say, hell, fuck this. I'm going to pick the horse. I'm going to put him over my shoulder and I'm going to run him to the wire first. When's the last time you saw that?
Probably about 50 years ago with Lafitte Pinkai carrying a few horses home in the stretch. But other than that, I'd say it's the horse, right?
It's the horse that does it.
Yeah.
You know, the jockeys get a lot of credit. Judy Shoemaker used to always say, I just stay out of their way.
You know? All right, well, this is a good spot to pause for part one, and we'll pick it up with part two. But this is great. We'll pick it up. You know, pick your brand some more about you know, the horses and how you use this information as a horse player. But for now, we'll pause here. I want to thank you, Bruno, for coming on, and we'll pick it up with part two in the next episode. But you know, until then, for all you horse players out there, thank you for listening, and may you boldly go where no horse player has gone before.